Greetings, friends. Welcome back, here by the fireside. This is critically acclaimed.
Ah, the fire! Ah! Oh! Ah!
Not, woo, I said beside the fire, not in it.
Oh, God! Let's get our signals crossed.
This is a film review podcast where we open the show with really dumb jokes. about sitting in fire. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic and writer of some stripe.
You write for some website. I write for Slash Film.
Yeah. And I'm rather prolific over there. Whether or not I'm any good is up for you to decide.
Oh my
God,
will
with
you
me
just
as always,
speak highly of yourself for once. My name is William Bibbiani. I write for The Wrap sometimes, but mostly I'm just a film critic, and you can call me Bibbs. And this week, uncritically acclaimed, reviewing a few films.
That's what we do on this podcast. Thanks for tuning in. This is our show where we review films. What are we reviewing, William?
You want to just start this podcast over?
No, keep going.
All right. Here's how the sausage gets made, folks. On some days when we have standards, we delete this. Here's what we're reviewing this week. We're reviewing the new Pixar movie, Lightyear. We're reviewing the new Joseph Kaczynski film, Spiderhead. That's right, the Top Gun Maverick guy.
The other new Joseph Kaczynski movie.
We've got the new Sundance hit, Cha-Cha, Real Smooth. And the latest remake of a Spencer Tracy classic, Father of the Bride.
This is the sixth film.
Sixth.
There are six, if you include this new one, it is the sixth one.
I think it's five. It's Father of the Bride.
Father of the Bride in 1950. Uh-huh. There was Father's Little Dividend in 51.
Yeah.
There was Father of the Bride in 1991 with Steve Martin. There was
Father of the Bride Part 2.
Part 2, which was in 95.
And then this.
Then there was Father of the Bride Part 3-ish, which came out in 2020.
What?
And now there's this one. So that's the sixth one.
When would Part 3 come out?
It was on the... It wasn't released on Netflix. It was released on the Netflix YouTube channel.
What?
So it was this little distaff sequel that kind of snuck past. But yeah, it exists. It's
what?
A thing. I assure you it's real.
What?
I haven't seen it, but I assure you it's
okay,
real.
Okay. In my defense, it is a short.
Okay.
It is not a feature. I did not miss a feature film.
Well, it still counts. It says part three in the title. Cast members came back to reprise their roles.
You know what? You know what? Yeah. I will watch this.
Okay.
Wow, Florence Pugh is in this? holy shit! What?
Do you want to pause the podcast just so you can watch this short and come back and review it?
Maybe. Robert De Niro is in this?
Robert De Niro's in it, too.
What the shit?
So,
no.
Yeah, it most certainly counts.
No, I won't watch this. No, I'm mad at them for hiding this from me. Next time, put it on fucking Netflix proper.
It's like when there's announcements here and there as like one of those things in production. They're going to make another Legally Blonde film.
Mm-hmm.
And Reese Witherspoon, all the headlines, Reese Witherspoon will be back for Legally Blonde 3. There was already a Legally Blonde 3.
Witherspoon produced it.
She produced it. It was called Legally Blondes. It was directed by Savage Steve Holland of Better Off Dead fame.
And it was about her character's cousins.
Yeah.
It's canon.
It is canonical. And Reese Witherspoon gave her blessing.
Yep, and this was not like something that got like flew under the radar. Like it's actual thing, but nope, we're just gonna pretend that didn't exist.
That didn't happen. Because so the next one is part three. This other one is the ghost dimension.
I hate it when they do that. In my defense, I totally would have said this was like number six if I had known three-ish existed.
Yeah, okay.
The Father of the Bride. So that's just me. That's me not knowing.
Speaking of weird canonical connections, can we start with Lightyear?
Please do, and I'm bummed out due to a frustrating combination of bad scheduling and having no money. I wasn't able to go see Lightyear, the new Pixar film. I thoroughly will, obviously. Like, I want to see it, but this is a new film. Now, here's the basic premise, and correct me if I'm wrong since you've seen it.
Yeah.
Andy... the little kid from the Toy Story movies.
The one who owned the toys in the Toy Story movies.
You know, the Cypher, who's just sort of a stand-in for generic youth. Mm. Well, he had a favorite movie, and apparently we're supposed to give a shit about that, so they made it.
Well, Buzz Lightyear is a popular character in Toy Story.
Well, sure is,
Buzz Lightyear and Woody the Cowboy are the two main toys. The plot of the first Toy Story from 1995, if you don't remember, is... Andy, the kid, loves his cowboy toy. It's got like a little pull string. That's Woody.
Yeah.
And his, and he, because he is the favorite toy, he's sort of like the chieftain of the toys in the room.
Yeah, the grand poobah.
Yeah, he kind of calls the shots. He's the captain. Just by dint of him being the most beloved.
Uh-huh. Which is really a shitty caste system, if you think about it. I'm loved more, therefore I have power over you.
Because they are inanimate objects, I'm okay with this.
Fine.
And then, of course, as the kid gets a little older, he becomes more enamored of a plastic spaceman toy.
Okay.
That is Buzz Lightyear. And Buzz Lightyear begins to supplant Woody in the young boy's mind. So
yeah, kid has a new favorite toy.
What happened in this kid's life that all of a sudden he's shifting focus? Well, in the original movie, he's just a little kid. He just loses attention for one thing and moves on to another thing.
We've all been kids who had, like, new toys marketed to us, and
this is my new favorite
toy. Yeah, He-Man was awesome, but now there are all these G.I. Joes. Mm. Well, now there are all these Teenage Ninja Turtles. Like, I didn't stop giving a shit, but for a while I'm playing with the turtles, damn it.
Yeah. So, the Lightyear begins with a Chiron in 1995, a little boy named Andy, liked Buzz Lightyear because of a movie he saw.
Uh-huh.
And this is the movie that he saw. So this is a movie sort of out of the Toy Story universe. It's not all that difficult to wrap your head around.
What weirds me out about that isn't that, okay, look, they made a Buzz Lightyear movie within the Toy Story universe. Easy.
Yeah.
Easy to understand. What's weird is that they make a huge point about Andy. As if what weirds me, and this is in like trailers and stuff. And so I can only speak to the trailers, but the trailers are like, and the little bits online, they're like showing like Andy's favorite movie, and I'm like, you are dramatically overestimating the emotional investment I have
in
like an 8-year old's favorite movie
in 1995.
Like Lightyear sounds like the kind of movie that like someone would invite, like when you're in college, someone would invite you over to their dorm. You haven't seen Lightyear from 1985. You got to come over and watch it. Then we watch this like old VHS, and that person like sits there watching you watch the
making
movie the
sure
whole
you're
time.
Reacting,
like
yeah.
you like that scene, right? Because that's the best scene.
Here's the thing. Given that I've seen a lot of, like, reassessment of shit, like, Scooby-Doo, the live-action Scooby-Doo movie is, like, recently had an anniversary.
Yeah.
And people are saying, no, this was, like, a subversive classic. It's actually a really, really intelligent movie.
No.
Like, okay. I'm old enough now that I'm seeing waves of nostalgia for crap I skipped 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to see it because I was too old.
Well, and also just, I think there's some movies that because... It's not just that they're bad and we've softened on them. Mm. It's they're part of like an ongoing series. So even though they might not be good, we keep revisiting them because
to sort of put them in context with the new whatever the new.
To put them in context, or just out of a sense of sort of this sort of collector's mentality, this completionism.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. For example, Moonraker isn't a very popular Bond movie, but there's a lot of people who have seen it multiple times because it's a Bond movie.
They, yeah, I want to see it with all the other Bond movies.
So. On that note, I think we're recording this the day of or the day after the 25th anniversary of when Batman and Robin came out. And I'm seeing people just be like, you know, time has been very kind to this film. It's actually a kind of a wonderful camp masterpiece. No!
It's difficult to get through.
It's actually really badly photographed.
Ugly to look at.
The editing is like clumsy and confused. And like, I love camp. If this was good camp, I'd be down for it. It's not good. I appreciate it, like, having fondness for what they were getting at, because really they made something kitschy on purpose.
Yeah.
They didn't do that by accident. But it doesn't make it good. I don't know.
So, the fact that we have to pay really close attention to what an 8-year-old liked in 1995 makes perfect sense to me.
Okay, you know what? That's a good argument, actually.
Because that happens all the time now.
You're not wrong, actually. That's a good... You should write an editorial about that. Actually, Lightyear is every damn think piece we see nowadays.
More or less.
Reassessing some movie from 1995.
The most interesting thing about this movie is that meta-narrative element.
Really?
And had they run with that, it would have been really interesting. What if they made this look like a kid's science fiction film from 1995?
It would look like that cinematic look, maybe effects.
Same kind of soundtrack, even if you want to.
Yeah.
Make it look like what's a kid's science fiction film that came out in 1995? Mighty Morphin Power Rangers came out
there
in 1995. Make it look like that. Make it look kind of trashy.
That'd be cool.
And I've seen that movie. And that movie is also trash.
That movie stinks a lot. It's not unfun.
There's an entertainment value to it. Playing the villain is clearly having a great time with
and
it.
It's the bad guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark, too.
Yeah. What is
his name?
The actor who played Belloc.
Yeah, oh, that's going to drive me nuts.
Freeman, I think, is his name.
I'll look it up. Hang on.
But they don't do, unfortunately, all of that, like, meta-narrative.
Paul Freeman.
Paul Freeman?
Paul Freeman.
Paul Freeman, all right. Yeah. I was going to say Sam Freeman. That's somebody else. Paul Freeman.
Hey, Luca.
They don't do anything with that fun meta-narrative, though. Like, if this is supposed to be a movie from within the Toy Story universe, maybe they could... And I'm not asking for, like, linking material or references, mm-hmm. but I'm asking for some kind of awareness of its place from the filmmakers.
You know what would have been amazing? If...
Add fake previews ahead of time.
Well, that would be cool. Yeah. But oh, God. And then you can milk those for a franchise, too. It'd be like the Pixar version of Grindhouse. You know what would have been really fun? If... so, like, the whole thing in Woody, the cowboy... Hi, Luca. Luca wants to hang out. Luca's my cat. Woody's Roundup was the cowboy show that Woody was from.
Okay.
Now, that's a real show in the Pixar Toy Story universe. That show had actors in it. What if the voice of Woody as an old man was a character in Lightyear playing one of the roles?
That would have been fun, right? Fake actors playing the animated roles.
That could be neat. There's so much possibility.
They don't do any of that. It's just straightforward sci-fi movie with Buzz Lightyear as a human being. It's really kind of pat, straightforward science fiction stuff. He is an astronaut for something called Star Command. They do that really insufferable thing where he's constantly narrating into like a wrist recorder, like Captain's Log.
Which is from the toy. Yeah.
But Buzz Lightyear is actually not a captain yet, so he's called out on like this embarrassing habit he has of narrating to himself. It's just something he likes to do for comfort, and they all kind of make fun. He's like, no, I don't do that. And there's... I hate that kind of awkward embarrassment humor, especially in kid movies. They do it all the time. And in exploring this sort of hostile planet where vines can sort of pull you under the ground... there's like, yeah, like living, almost sentient plants that reach up from under the ground. He's trying to escape. They almost leave a rookie behind. He is the one piloting a ship. They accidentally crashes. And everybody who's on board the ship, it's like this colony ship full of cryogenically frozen people, have to get out and essentially start building civilization. Over the course of the next few years, they build up something that will allow them to travel super fast. Buzz Lightyear tries, fails, but when he returns, 4 years have passed because of space travel. All
right.
And then he tries multiple times, so almost 65 years have passed. So a lot of time has passed down on this planet, and he hasn't aged.
Well, that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the adventure proper begins. He finally lands in the future. He's disconnected with everybody. He meets the child of his old captain, who is now a young adult.
Yeah.
And now he has to fight a mysterious alien spaceship run by a robot named Zurg, which is also a character from Buzz Lightyear, from Toy Story.
I'm sorry, Luca, my cat,
wants to be cradled.
Well, he wanted to jump up on my lap, and then, like, I picked him up, and he immediately fell asleep. So now I am a living cat. This is my life now.
Speaking of cats, there is a robot cat in Lightyear. It's probably the best part. It's an intelligent...
I'm shocked. The cat is the best part.
It's an intelligent robot cat that speaks English, and when Buzz Lightyear is going on his mission, like 60 years past, the cat has been working out the calculations. So when he arrives like 60 years, like, oh, I figured out that problem. the cat figured it out.
That's cute.
And he ends up having to team up with a young woman and two ex-cons. One of them is played by Taika Waititi to fight the alien menace. That's it.
There's
not a lot of wit or cleverness to this, apart from that sort of time-lapse thing. They don't really play with it. Once they get into sort of the main time frame of the movie, they just kind of stay there and do that.
Well, let me ask
And there's nothing clever... There's a bit of a twist at the end, but it's not an entirely creative or interesting twist.
Well, the idea of playing around with relativity and the idea that, to him, a very short amount of time passes, but because he was going at or faster than the speed of light, he comes back and everyone else is aged. There's an element of tragedy to that, of life passing him by. Is it... Because here's the thing about the better Pixar movies, which is most of them, honestly, at least in terms of their ambitions.
The last three that went straight to Disney Plus were better than this.
Well, that may be the case, but that's not what I was getting at. But those last three are a good example of Pixar movies that are about something significant.
Yes.
You know, like Soul was about finding
mortality, isn't it?
Yeah. Was about mortality, and it was about finding your life's purpose. It was finding the reason to go on living. Luca, a little bit more chill, but it's very much a coming-of-age story. It's also the closest Pixar has ever done to talking about queerness in any meaningful way.
It's subtext.
It's subtext, but it's the closest they've come.
Except in they're queer characters in like backgrounds. One of the supporting characters in this, she has a wife,
uh-huh.
and she kisses her wife in one scene. We don't even see like their lips touch. It's like her head leans in front of the other.
Is it something that could be easily cut?
Yeah.
Then that doesn't count.
No, it totally doesn't count.
All right, my point was this. You know what?
Actually, there's other lines of dialogue talking about her wife.
Well, good. But my point is this. My point is this. Luca, at the very least, was largely about that relationship.
Yeah.
And then Turning Red actually had a lot of great things to say about puberty and about multiple generations growing up in a particular cultural background. These are things that are... They're movies that are not just about their plot. They're about important stuff.
Mm. They're about life.
What is Lightyear about?
That's the frustrating thing. It's not. It's
you've
like
got all that relativity stuff. There's so much drama there.
And there's a few moments of it, but this has that that really kind of modern blockbuster problem where there's way too much incident. They depict all of that: the ship crashing, the civilization building, the attempts. By the time he gets to that tragic bit where he realizes a lot of time has passed, we're like 30, 40 minutes into this movie.
Yeah.
And so, if this is going to be the crux of it, it needs to be the crux of it. It needs to be about him getting used to living in the distant future when, you know, life has sort of passed him by and whether or not he's comfortable with that. Now, of course, if you do that, is this the kind of movie that Andy would like? I think if they had maybe made it more too much like a Pixar movie, then it wouldn't have been the type of movie that would have fit into Toy Story. So,
why do you say that? Why do you feel like this is? Does Andy have bad taste in movies? Is that what we're arguing here?
I'm saying like, that a little kid who becomes obsessed with toys is going more likely to be obsessed with something like Lightyear than they are with something like Soul.
But that's genre. That doesn't necessarily mean quality.
You could fill a canyon with the Unsold Soul Onward and Inside Out merchandise.
Well, I can appreciate that, but I think that's a matter of genre as much as anything else, right? There's a lot of genre movies that don't move toys.
Yeah.
But do you feel like based on that watching Lightyear, as is the sort of thing that Andy would be like, this will become my life now. This is my favorite movie.
I'm learning from think pieces about Scooby-Doo. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, fair enough.
it's hard to say what a young person is becoming obsessed with. I'm old. I'm not connected to my. The closest I have is my son, and he's not going to watch a movie.
Okay, I got to put you down. I'm sorry. I tried putting him down before, and he just went limp. He was like, I'm not like doing it.
Liquid cat.
Yeah.
It's not ambitious. It's really frustrating that Pixar has been falling back more and more on their older properties.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do something really sort of creative or interesting, Disney is sort of, it's difficult to think, and this is where I'm sort of stepping out and trying to look at it from a business perspective, which I hate doing.
Well, we're trying to rationalize decisions that are being made. It doesn't mean we approve.
But what I've been seeing Disney doing with their Pixar product is kind of sidelining it a little bit. And I think a lot of it has to do with essentially marketability, lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Lightyear, technically, because it has this recognizable character, is on paper the more toyetic thing. It's got spaceships. It's got, you know, space aliens and robots and spacemen. You can make toys out of, and he already was a toy anyway.
Just
make him into a toy again.
Compared to Soul, definitely. Mm. Compared to Luca, pretty much.
Mm.
I would buy the hell out of a Turning Red panda. I would if they had like a big squishy one, I would buy that.
What was it? The boy bands, like Forever.
Was it Fortown?
Fortown. They put out like a fake Fortown record, I would buy that.
Yeah, I would totally buy that. That'd be great.
I mean, Josie and the Pussycats, they actually had all those songs in the movie. They'd have to come up with, like, all these new songs. But why not? Have, a little EP. The Four Town EP. It's, like, five tracks.
Whatever. Like, seriously.
It's from 2002. You put it on CD anyway.
It's so easy. Like, I say this knowing that I couldn't do it, but, like, we're just asking for generic studio hits from, like, the 2000s. I guarantee you someone's got, like, a file cabinet full of sheet music for rejected NSYNC songs that are good enough to be a Four Town record, you know? Like, come on, just whip them out. What the hell?
They hired the singers to play those Four Town
Bernard characters. Herrmann allegedly wrote an entire opera for Citizen Kane. We hear it for about 1 minute.
But he wrote the whole opera.
Yeah. You can write a Four Town record.
Yeah, you're gonna you can write
get that shit done. What are you doing?
This is off topic, but I have a cassette that they put out in promotion of Guardians of the Galaxy. It was a tie-in with Dairy Queen. And
what?
You could go to Dairy Queen and you could get a cassette. Evidently, these things aren't too... There's like 10,000, which is like a low run as far as these sorts of things go. And if you listened all the way to the end, they would say at the very end, like, this is a winner and you win $1 million. Or for the most part, this is not a winning cassette, but thanks for listening.
Yeah.
The songs are all about Dairy Queen products. It's like they try to make it sound like...
Are they parodies of real songs?
No, they're just like... They try to make it sound like vague 80s rock instrumentals.
Oh my god.
Like, we're gonna sing about a cookie and a brownie. They call it a brookie. Go to Dairy Queen. It's a real thing.
Oh my god. I really want to hear this now.
Yeah, it's
I'm sure someone's uploaded it to YouTube by now. But
you can probably listen to it on YouTube. God, but I actually have the cassette, and I listened to it on my cassette.
Was it a winner?
No, it was not a winner.
Ah!
If I had won $1 million, you would have
You've been keeping this for me this whole time? We've been working on this laptop this whole time?
What are you doing? Yeah, would have bought us a studio.
You've been like just living in your apartment this whole time to fool me?
I could get $1 million or lifetime supply of Dairy Queen.
Ooh, well, you chose wisely. Yeah, you'll never go hungry. Except you will, because where is there a Dairy Queen around
here? I was going to say, I'll never be healthy either. Allegedly. I'm trying to take the curse off of my slag on Dairy Queen.
I'm sure a giant bowl full of ice cream and Oreos is exactly what you need to grow up big and strong.
Say you need 2,000 calories a day, I get it in one meal, it's great.
No chewing required.
Lightyear ultimately is, as I say, quite disappointing.
Okay.
There's all of this potential to do this weird, meta-narrative, because that's the only thing it really has going for it, and they chose to do the least ambitious thing possible. And I've complained about this before, how Pixar and Disney are almost crossing paths in terms of their creativity. I remember when Brave came out, how that felt sort of like kind of a generic fantasy comedy adventure.
It felt a little bit more akin to what they were doing with stuff like Tangled.
Yeah, like it was a little bit sort of like winky. There were there's a witch in that movie, and there's like a answering machine joke with the witch. That's a Disney kind of joke.
I like that movie, but it did not feel like the Pixar film of that.
Exactly,
era.
It didn't feel like clever or interesting in any kind of way.
It's
kind of
clever, but it's not super.
They started making a lot of sequels to their stuff. A lot of the sequels I like. I like Monsters U.
That's great.
I think Cars 3 is actually pretty good.
Agreed.
But yeah, it's like they've just been running on fumes for a long time, and then they finally came out with a few really good ones. Because I like Onward. I know
you like it more than I do. Weren't a big fan. It's okay. Yeah. It just didn't really grab me, but it's fine.
The big realization at the end about sort of his relationship with his brother, I think, was actually very tender.
I think that's the kind of revelation that's going to mean more depending on the relationship you have, like with your siblings. It's going to hit some people really, really hard. And for me, I'm like, I get it.
Yeah.
Like, that's it didn't really bring me in, but it's good. It's a good movie. I don't dislike it.
Yeah, great opportunity to make the main character queer in that one, but they didn't. Anyway, and then they also did Soul, which, not a film I love, but I think it's creative. They at least are, envisioning a different version of the afterlife.
I love the vision of the afterlife. I think it's very creative. I don't think the story actually works all that well.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, it's not a bad movie.
Soul's okay, but I did really like Luca, and Luca's really like nice. Turning Red.
Turning Red rules.
And so it's like, we're kind of sort of bringing it around. We're making it a little bit more character. We're trying to be a little bit more clever about the premise. Like, sea monsters in Italy want a Vespa. That's a story I haven't seen before.
I have not seen that
before.
So
there you go. Yeah. I've seen Turning Red is like a riff on a movie like Teen Wolf.
Oh yeah, that's been done, but it's still
it's done very stylishly with a lot of character and earnestness.
I can't think of a better version of it. Maybe equally as good, but I can't think of a better version.
I mean, I like Turning Red better than I like Teen Wolf.
Well, Teen Wolf is not a particularly good movie, but like there are other good versions of that.
Yeah, and then they come back to theaters, and we're sort of back into resting on our laurels.
Is
we're
that just bad timing, though? I mean, like this happens to be the next one that comes out.
Look, I'm not a marketer. I don't know what order they put these in. I don't know how they planned it. All I know is that this is the first big theatrical release, and it's also their least interesting in a long time.
Well, it doesn't seem to be doing terribly
like well. Their first big one, like Onward, was released theatrically.
It was, but it was the last week before the pandemic.
It was right before pandemic. People were already staying. A lot of money.
Theaters weren't closed down yet, but people were already staying away in droves. Like, it was just bad timing.
So yeah, Onward lost a lot of money because of that, and also nobody wants to buy the Onward stuff. Who wants a toy pair of pants that your dad is wearing?
Okay, you know what? I would actually buy those pants.
You can get those.
I would buy the pants if I had the
you
pants.
You can get an action figure of just the pants.
I would.
I guess they put like a fake torso, so it's that. But
I wouldn't want that.
You don't want the one.
I just want the pants.
The fake torso.
Okay. I just want the pants. I don't want the torso.
The joke in Onward is they want to resurrect the two main characters want to resurrect their dead father, and they live in a world where magic is real. And, and they do it, but the spell is a little bit awry, so they can only resurrect him from his feet up to his waist. Yeah. And the top half of him is missing, so they have their father's legs, like disembodied legs,
and they have like
around with
24 hours to finish the spell so they can spend the rest of those 24 hours with their father, or else they'll only get to spend time with his legs. Mm. I appreciate how weird that is.
Yeah.
That's a fun bit of weirdness. My last question about Lightyear, and this is just something that I feel like the marketing was trying to push this, because obviously Turning Red is marketed towards and about kids. Same thing with Luca. Soul, not so much. Lightyear, it felt like a lot of the marketing for Lightyear, a lot of the trailers for Lightyear, were trying to sell this as this is a serious sci-fi summer movie.
Yeah.
You know, they had that really nice epic rendition of David Bowie's Starman, which is remixed a bit. And
I didn't see any previews.
Sold it really well and made it feel really epic.
All right.
It maybe didn't sell the concept, but the tone was, this is not Pixar for kids. This is a PG-13, you know, action sci-fi movie that just happens to be animated. Mm. Does it feel like that, or does it feel like a kids movie?
Because it's so unsophisticated, it feels like a kid's movie.
That's unfortunate.
In design, it looks like, you know, I mean, it just looks like any sort of, like, crafting space-bound video game you might play.
Mm-hmm.
Had this been, like, a proper space opera, which there's been a Buzz Lightyear animated series.
Yes, there is. Quite a long
Patrick
one.
Patrick Warburton played Buzz Lightyear in that one. And that is an expansive space opera. It's about tripping from ship to ship and a whole cast of aliens and what Buzz Lightyear does as part of this Star Command, which is Starfleet. It's Star Trek.
I saw one episode.
It's any number of things. And that actually had sort of a broader scope of mythology than something like Lightyear, which doesn't really let us know the broader place Star Command plays, the year it takes place. Is this speculative like Star Trek? Is this alternate galaxy like Star Wars? And it looks like they weren't really thinking of any of that. They just wanted to do a space adventure with Buzz Lightyear. They weren't thinking big.
No.
And that hurts the movie. Its ambitions are so low that it becomes less too uninteresting.
Well, speaking of not really thinking big, let's talk about Spider-Head.
Spider-Head is the other big film from director Joseph Kosinski, who has a big hit in theaters right now, called Top Gun Maverick, which is actually still doing better at the box office than Lightyear. That's been the big news this week.
Yeah, you know what? It's quite good. It's a well-made film, and I actually like most of Joseph Kosinski's work. He did Tron Legacy, which is
iffy.
I think it's entertainingly trippy. I think it's better than the original. A bit of a low bar, but
I was about to say though, neither is great. I like the visual, the visual in that first Tron. They spent so much money trying to get that look, and it looks cheap as It looks really, really awful. But I kind of like how shabby, yet also expensive it looks. Like it has this really bizarre look to it.
He also did Oblivion with Tom Cruise, which is
a sci-fi film. I kind of like.
I think it's a little derivative, but it's okay. He did a pretty good biopic called Only the Brave, which is about a heroic firefighters starring Josh Brolin and Miles Teller.
I don't think
it kind of came and went. Like, there was a brief moment where people thought it would have Oscar buzz, and it just didn't.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's good. It's well made. And then, yeah, Top Gun Maverick is kind of a big deal.
Joseph Kosinski has now proven with something like Tron, he's making sequels like Tron and Top Gun. And,
yeah.
Now with Spider-Head, he's really proving that he is a certain kind of very well-polished director. Oblivion is really tightly structured.
Yep.
And I think Spider-Head has a lot of slickness to it. It actually has really great production design.
Mm-hmm.
He's attracted a really good cast. He's working with Miles Teller again, because Miles Teller wasn't only The Brave, he was also in Top Gun.
Yep.
And here, he's making a trippy kind of science fiction prison movie, which wouldn't have felt too out of place in the 70s.
I was thinking that the entire time. This definitely feels like a 1970s sci-fi film back in the days where we would use a lot more stark aesthetics and a lot more big ideas in exchange for not having like big set pieces.
Yeah.
So, like, this is the kind of film you would get for something like Silent Running, THX-1138.
Logan's Run, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely it definitely feels like you watch a lot of 70s sci-fi in order to get this film.
And so Miles Teller is a prisoner in this really posh medical facility.
Yeah.
On this, like, pier out on an island somewhere.
Yeah, it turns out that there's a lot of prisoners who have volunteered to be part of a medical study, presumably to
commute their sentence.
And the medical study is being run by Chris Hemsworth, who plays a scientist who is testing a new series of drugs that have very pronounced impacts. They can make
mood altering drugs.
Yeah, mostly things like they could make you immediately fall in lust with somebody, or they'll make you full of rage, or they'll make you terrified of the very first thing that you see. And Miles Teller and Jurnee Smollett and a bunch of other people are engaged in all of these experiments, but Miles Teller begins to suspect that these experiments have more sinister overtones and that Chris Hemsworth is not to be trusted. Even because he makes it seem like, hey, listen, I took you out of real prison and got you into this place, which is almost like a dorm. Like, we have snacks, like you're allowed to kind of wander free.
He has an open door policy, so people can just sort of come and go in his office. And I was reminded of that bit in The Silence of the Lambs. Like, and every month you can walk on the beach, you can swim in the ocean under SWAT team surveillance, of course.
Yeah.
So they can go out for a walk out in nature, but there's like guards with guns right behind them.
Do you remember the name of the island?
Plum Island. It's a real place.
Anthrax Island.
Yeah, it was actually a disease research facility. Yeah. Is that you? Yeah, that was me.
Yeah.
That was good.
So pissed about it too. Like, damn it, that was the thing that got me.
I will say this. They do eventually reveal what sort of the sinister plot is that Chris Hemsworth might be up to.
Yeah.
And it's a little underwhelming.
It's spectacularly underwhelming.
Because there isn't a lot of energy given to sort of the broader scope as to what he's doing out in the outer world with this stuff, what he intends to do. Had they revealed that earlier on, had it been bigger, that would have been like a better script. What this movie does instead is a lot of character stuff. There's a lot of interplay between the Miles Teller and Chris Hemsworth characters, and a lot of conversations they have about how they don't really trust each other and how they have just very different outlooks on life.
Yeah.
So some of their conversations, even if they're not have nothing to do with the plot or like character building moments, they are character building moments. And I'll say this. This is Chris Hemsworth's best performance.
You really think so?
He is great in this. I think he has
this... I don't know if I'm with you on that.
He has this wonderful, like, flip sinisterness that you read and you understand why he's charming. You understand why everybody goes along with what he does, but you also understand that he's up to no good.
Yeah.
I appreciate that there is a line of dialogue that addresses how handsome he is.
Yeah. There is a bit where he's talking about how, like, pretty people tend to have a kind of easy. And he turns around and it's like, hey, and me too. I've had it way too easy.
Yeah, he's like, look at me. And he's like, he's wearing these, like, shirts that show off his gigantic biceps.
Constantly working out.
He is going to be in another Thor movie. He plays Thor, and when you play a superhero, you have to get in, like, fighting shape.
Yeah,
you have to really bulk up for those movies. Yeah. So I'm guessing he was already bulked up for Thor.
I think that's just where you're at when you play Thor. You have to, like, play characters who look that way. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish, because he's this fucking god, who cares, like, if he has actual muscles? Like, I wish we had just let him stay a little plump like he was at the end of Endgame.
Here's
like,
what
I liked having a superhero that looked like a person.
I have always hated in superhero movies and stories where they're shown working out. Like, they have to maintain their physique. No, the fantasy is you don't.
Yeah.
The fantasy is you just have the physique and you don't have to try with it. Yeah, it's like, what is lifting going to do? Make you even stronger still?
I don't mind it when Batman does it because Batman...
Batman's a guy.
Batman's just regular. But Superman? Superman's...
Or like...
Yeah.
It's like when, like, Wonder Woman, we're going to have games. It's like, no, you should just be naturally expert in all this stuff because you're a superhero.
I'm not sure I agree with you that this is a great Chris Hemsworth performance. I like him in it.
I think he's really great. I think he's, like, delving into a lot of pathos. There's a wonderful scene with him and Miles Teller where they are, they're taking sort of like a laughing gas drug. They have these little, like, packs on their lower spines.
It's Cronenbergian if Cronenberg didn't want them to look like flesh. Like, it just looks like an iPod attached to their back.
Yeah, so it's really kind of, it's more Kaczynski. That's his thing. You know, like, sort of slick machines. And yeah, they have, like, these colorful little vials that they insert into these things.
Otter Pops, like little tiny Otter Pops.
And there's one of them is like it's like a laughing drug. Yeah. It like just makes you really.
I think,
like,
they call it Laugh-A-Dil.
Something like that. Yeah. I have expected them to call it Gleam-A-Nex from the Kids in the Hall movie.
I was thinking about Kids in the Hall. The Kids in the Hall movie, if you've never seen it, is all about the creation of the ultimate antidepressant. Which makes people, like, super duper happy all the time.
Like to a distracted degree, and eventually they fall into, like, these bliss comas.
Yeah,
and,
like becomes apocalyptic.
The ethics of that. There's this wonderful scene where he and Miles Teller are just sort of hanging out in his office, like his fancy home, and they're just sort of blissing out on this, like, Laugh-A-Dil. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, it's not even going to work. Share with me your worst memory.
Yeah.
And they get to share these really harrowing things that happen to them while they're laughing. And I think
that was a good thing.
The way they sell it and the way they bond in this really fake kind of way, I think, is a really great scene.
Here's why I'm not as high on his performance as you are, which I think is a charismatic performance. And I think he gets that part really well. He gets that part of the villain who wants to be your friend.
Yeah.
You know, like the person who is manipulating you because they are trying to make you convinced that they are your friend and they owe you one. And we've all met people like that. Not necessarily this cartoonishly evil, but we've all. But here's where I think he doesn't deliver. He's playing a mad scientist. He's playing a super genius. And at no point when I'm watching this do I get the distinct impression that he's thinking the variables out. That he's actually consciously thinking. I get that if he was the spokesperson of whatever company he works for, perfect. He's awesome. Well, he's nailing it. But the fact that he's also supposed to be kind of like, I don't know, Lex Luthor or something, or whatever, he's not, I don't get that, like, twinkle in the eye of great intelligence. Not that I think he's not smart, but I don't think I get from him the idea that he is so ingenious and so hyper-focused that he would come up with this as grand a scheme and the kind of technology that we have in this movie. That never really fully tracks for me.
I'm not
100% convinced. I like him in it, but I feel like he's a little... You know what I was thinking of when I was, like, watching this? Like, when I was watching this movie, which again, it's very stark, it's very insular, it's amazing, like, how expensive these Netflix movies are, because it's actually a pretty modest movie in a lot of ways. Most of it takes place
really
in Golden.
Really great production design.
It does, but it's not gigantic. It's actually very, very reasonable. There's definitely a $10 million version of this movie you could have easily done on, like, an Ex Machina or a Cube budget. But regardless, I was thinking about, like, if this movie were made in the 70s, who would star in it? And I was like, you know who would be the Chris, like, Hemsworth role?
Olivier, maybe?
I was thinking Oliver Reed.
Oh, there you go, Oliver Reed.
But either way, Olivier, Oliver Reed, these are people who are, you see them constantly scheming. And I don't see that from him.
He doesn't something like intelligence.
He doesn't project sinister intelligence. He just projects sinisterness, which is not the same thing.
Well, I think, though, that he is reminiscent. They're clearly modeling him off of an Elon Musk type, a Steve Jobs type, like one of those like modern like young hip tech billionaires.
Yeah.
So, you know, Oliver Reed doesn't play roles like that.
Yeah.
So he is obsessed with image. He likes the way everything looks.
Uh-huh.
Everything's really sort of slick and expensive to the point where you can tell he's distracted by sort of surface level stuff.
Here's
so what, I think it plays fine with the character.
It's not bad.
It plays totally fair.
It's not bad, but here's what I was just thinking about this. You're bringing up, you know, basing him off of modern tech giants, and I was thinking about another movie, very recent movie that did a character very much the same way, and that's Campbell Scott in Jurassic World Dominion.
I know.
But like, let's be honest here. Campbell Scott exudes that hyper focused mad genius quality.
Okay.
And I kind of honestly think if you switched actors and put Campbell Scott in Spider-Head and Chris Hemsworth in Dominion, which is a much more I am coasting on charm kind of bad guy.
Okay.
I actually think the movies would be better.
They are similar characters. The comparison is fair. I feel like he's because he produced this as well. This is clearly something he was really passionate about.
And I'm not telling him he shouldn't have done it. I just think
this is the first time I've seen him play an American, and I think he does that really well.
Is this the first time you've seen him? Did you see? I don't know.
I've seen him play like. I think he's played English characters a Norwegian character, technically.
I'm trying to remember if he played an American in the reboot of Vacation.
I think it was an Australian character.
Was he Australian in Ghostbusters? Okay, then I just don't remember.
Yeah, it was Australian in Ghostbusters as well.
All right.
He was very funny in Ghostbusters.
He was. He's hilarious in Ghostbusters. I think he's a very funny actor.
Oh, no, he's great. Yeah. And I feel like he's waiting for that, like, Brad Pitt breakthrough moment where he gets to do, like a more interesting character role.
I think he needs to have someone write something around his strength.
Well, that's what this was supposed to be. This wasn't written for a strength. This was written by, actually, we've talked to them before.
Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick.
Paul Wernick.
Rhett Reese actually came on our Patreon once to do a podcast about Lonesome Dove, which is he was a huge fan of.
And we got to interview them both because they wrote the Deadpool movies So this is them, you know, sort of riffing, I think, on a lot of that sort of 70s sci-fi stuff. And this is something that Chris Hemsworth was passionate about enough to produce. And I do think he's actually hitting all the right notes with this character.
I think he's more than I do.
Because he's clearly not the one masterminding it. He is trying to sell this product. He is a pitch man. So we get that.
I don't think the end of the movie really justifies that. It really does feel
it's all covered in dialogue. He says that he's going to sell this. He's going to make a lot of money off of it.
Well, of course he is, but he's still the one masterminding it. It's not like he's only selling it. That's not the same thing.
It's sort of like the hustle culture version of this. I'm going to invent this thing so I can sell it. I just want to be even richer than I am.
Fair enough, but he still had to be the kind of person who could make it as well, and this is not easy stuff.
I don't know that. It just comes easy to him.
Maybe. Here's
sort of rock and roll scientist is a thing. Look at Adrian Brody in Splice.
Or heck,
even Matt Damon in any Matt Damon movie.
I know. But Matt Damon doesn't usually play a mad scientist.
He plays intelligent characters a lot.
Here's what, for me, we focus way more on Chris Hemsworth than I thought we would. Here's, for me, the actual thing holding this movie back. Because I like the general premise. I like the overall aesthetic, and I like the cast, even though I think Chris Hemsworth is maybe not 100% right for it, but I do like him in it. This movie, and I can't go into great detail without giving away what happens in it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a sci-fi movie about, like, mood-altering experiments. It's a movie that has a theme, you know. Like most movies.
It's about something.
But I'm waiting for the movie to fully reveal what it's about. Because obviously Chris Hemsworth is hiding stuff. Some of the stuff he's hiding that, like, Miles Teller sees, like, this is a little thing. In fact, they allude to it earlier. But Miles Teller finds out that, like, oh my god, he's naming all the drugs after pisses on a bingo card. Uh-huh. And I'm like, that's not evil. That's not even. You gotta name him after something. Who gives a shit what he names it? That doesn't mean anything. Why are we making that into a big deal?
That is not an interesting plot point.
That's my point. It's like they're making a big deal out of this weird thing, and I'm waiting to see what is important.
What was significant about that is there's like a spot that was unfulfilled.
I realize that, but the main, he makes a big deal out of it, and he's naming it after a bingo card. Like, he's focusing on that.
Yeah.
As if that is somehow meaningful, and not like, you know, usually when they make drugs, they, like, have, like, random names assigned to them. There's actually, like, a list of just generic drug names. They don't necessarily mean anything. Mm. But in any case, I'm watching this movie, I'm waiting for it to, like, to blossom like a flower, to reveal what it's really about. And I realize that what I'm waiting for, really, is, because this is kind of a dystopian kind of thing. It's about, you know, prisons that are being used as for-profit guinea pig experiments. This is about control. This is about all these kinds of things. I'm waiting to find out what the movie is mad at. What's your point? Why did you feel the need to make this? Like, what are you trying to get at? Like, Ex Machina is about misogyny. What is this about? Mm. And what it is about is ultimately rather generic and not very interesting, and I feel like they're not actually getting at anything that is truly inherent to the premise of the text. I feel like what they're actually getting at is really straightforward and just sort of like, hey, you know what's cool? Not being controlled by drugs. And I'm like, yeah, I don't really know if I needed Spiderhead for that. I feel like I wanted to know what this movie's, like, morals were and what their ethos was. Like, what is it about society that you feel that this is makes this story relevant? Mm. And ultimately what it feels like is this is just a very insular story about this experiment, and it doesn't really connect to a lot, and that makes it feel way smaller than it needs to.
What I connected to on this movie, and the reason why I think I think that the script has a lot of issues. I think the big reveals aren't as big as they ought to be.
Yeah.
I feel like there could have been a lot more exploration as to the significance of the big revelation.
Exactly my point. I want to know more about.
But what I'm getting out of this movie, what it's about, is anti-entrepreneurship. This idea that we've been sold for the last, like, 20 years, and this is something that's been sold to millennials, this false bill of goods, that you can work hard and you can take over an industry. You can be the one to shake it up. You can be,
ethical billionaire.
You can be, that's the lie, isn't it? You can be the ethical billionaire. And you'll notice a lot of the language, especially going back to, like, the mid to late 2000s, was not about entering the marketplace. It was always about like shaking it up. You're gonna be, you're gonna redefine it. You're gonna subvert everything. You're gonna be the one who emerges from outside the box. All of that kind of language.
Yeah,
and that it created this whole new fire festival related breed of sort of very flashy, self-driven, self-obsessed kind of entrepreneurs that are kind of selling a false bill of goods. They might have actually been good at something along the way.
We had an entire generation of Lex Luthor billionaires.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is just another one of, this is sort of like a reaction to that. This is a science fiction movie that says, hey, I can be this entrepreneurial billionaire. And you know what? On paper, he's handsome. He looks like Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah.
He's got huge biceps. He's very, very rich. He has these miraculous talents that could actually do good in the world. And he's only doing it to just sort of, like, dick around because he's not a very thoughtful person.
Right.
I think I saw a documentary about the founder of American Apparel, for instance.
Oh, yeah, I saw that too, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it on Quibi. And I think it's on Roku now, so you can actually watch it. It's called
I forget.
Wolfman, or Wolf something. I forgot the title of the American Apparel movie. It was about how he had this
Big Rad Wolf.
Big Rad Wolf, that was it.
Yeah.
Watch Big Rad Wolf. I actually like that documentary. And it's a very interesting snapshot as to what was going on in, like, marketing in, like, the late 2000s.
Really interesting, yeah.
You know, sort of where I think where a lot of Spiderhead is coming from. Because he did have this interesting idea. He was able to sell, like, t-shirts and get, you know, he was actually trying to produce these things really ethically.
Mm-hmm.
Sweatshop free, that was one of the big selling points of American Apparel. It was all produced in L.A., and, you know, all of the workers were paid really well, and the guy who founded it was actually a champion for workers' rights, and he would, like, go on picket lines and stuff and make sure his workers were treated well. He was also brought to court for a lot of sexual crimes, so he wasn't a great guy in that regard. But the whole point is, everybody who was working for American Apparel in its heyday saw this wild guy who was doing all these unethical things, ethical and unethical things.
Yeah.
And they weren't being paid really well. They were working 23 hours a day. They were sleeping under their desks because they thought they could be part of something really exciting.
Yeah.
And I feel
we're
like
we're going to follow this person and a cult of personality, exactly. And they're going to take over the world. Yeah.
That's what I'm getting out of Spider-Head. It's about this guy who has sort of bought into that image, that that's what he wants to be. He wants to be this titan of industry, but he doesn't have an idea. He's really good at something, and he's not applying it in any kind of meaningful way. He's doing it for his own gratification.
I see where you're coming from, but here's... okay, so you're saying it's about this billionaire, and
it's about false billionaire culture.
And here's my issue with that. It's not about him. It's about Miles Teller, and Miles Teller's story is about a guy who's incarcerated for doing something which isn't revealed specifically what it was until later. Something very sad in his past, and it's about him and Jurnee Smollett, like overcoming these tragedies in their past, and those don't really connect a lot. To Chris Hemsworth, and in fact,
no issues with that whatsoever.
I think it betrays the focus, and I think when the focus is not on this character, then it's really hard to say that that character is the movie's focus, and this is what the movie is really about. And as a result, I find it kind of muddled and bifurcated.
Well, we have to have a human character to look at this asshole.
I understand that, but I think I ultimately
it could have been about the asshole, but I think we're giving a little bit more of a critical eye by seeing him from the outside.
I appreciate that, but I also think that when you come right down to it, it doesn't feel like what the movie is really obsessed with or concerned about for most of it. And even like the final voiceover monologue doesn't even mention him. Like, I don't think it's really about that. I think it's in there, but that's kind of my point, is I kind of think it's a little muddled, and I don't think they really made this with a major thematic purpose. I think it's all just sort of thrown into the mix, and you can get that what you got out of it, sure, but I actually think if the movie were more intensified and was more unafraid to directly be about what it is about, like to actually like really approach it, and not just through this like lens of what's going on in this Spider-Head prison, but actually, by the way, the title means nothing, it's just the name of a room, but like, if it was actually, like, you said it yourself, if you actually saw this connected to the outside world more, it would be stronger.
Yeah.
And I think it would also be more... And I think it would be more focused, because then we would see, like, what's this really, really about? I find it just, like, kind of like... This feels like a great 30-minute short need to be a feature. It just feels like we don't have that much content for it.
I'm seeing a lot of parallels here between this film and the conversation you and I had about Oblivion. Is another film that has sort of a Twilight Zone premise,
there's definitely a mystery, and it's pretty obvious there is a mystery. Again, what probably is.
There's a mystery. You kind of figure out what it is. It's something I've seen in science fiction movies before.
You're waiting for the protagonist to catch up.
I like the style of that movie so much that I was okay with sort of a little bit of a simple story in that case.
Yeah.
And you could say the same thing about Top Gun. There's nothing going on in that movie.
Not especially, no.
Slick as fuck.
It's very slick.
It's incredibly entertaining.
Well, this is kind of what I'm getting at. Joseph Kaczynski is not a very character-driven director in a lot of ways.
He's very technical, and I feel like he is creating movies that are so tightly locked together that he's not really bothering to delve into the script too deeply.
Yeah.
And there are cases in which you can forgive that. I could do it with Oblivion. I can do it with Spider-Head. Top Gun, less so. I think everybody else can do it better with Top Gun than I could.
By the way, I want to say, I think Only the Brave is an exception to this. It's actually a pretty good character piece.
Okay, yeah, that's the one
I know you haven't seen it. I will go to bad for it. I know not a badly made.
And same with Tron. You know, there's a lot of interesting visual stuff in that movie.
A lot of interesting concepts.
They introduce a lot of ideas and then just sort of like sneeze them all over your face. Yeah.
I don't think he's a particularly humane filmmaker. Not that he's inhuman, but I don't think he's as interested in the human experience. And as a result, a lot of the stuff about we're overcoming our trauma and shit, I'm like, no, I don't think that's what you're interested in. I think you're interested in the big ideas, and I don't think the big ideas are very focused.
Yeah, I think Miles Teller and the other characters were the sort of the human face of this. I think Chris Hemsworth was the sort of entrepreneurial tech billionaire villain that has been born of a generation of that thinking, and I found the twist not to be so interesting, but a lot of the interactions between the characters to be interesting, because I find the Chris Hemsworth character so interesting.
I think what would have sold it better is if maybe, if you were going for what you're going for, let's assume that for a second. You're talking about, you compare it to the guy, the American Peril guy, whose name I don't remember and I don't care to. People believed in that guy. They followed him. And there's one character in the movie who does seem to have this sort of hero worship of him, but by the time we're introduced to him in the movie, he's a couple of days away from being over Chris Hemsworth's shit.
Yeah.
If all of these criminals were, like, really grateful to him and, like, hey, thank you for imprisoning us in a better way, and, like, actually, like, it seems a little bit more utopian, and then we realize how dystopian it was, that might have been a stronger play. But even from the beginning, I don't... That's my point. I just think it's all one note.
I think it's less interesting.
I think it's all one note, though.
All right.
That's my thing. I think if we had actually seen the fall... from thinking this is great to falling apart, that would have been stronger. But anyway, we've talked about it for a very long time. Let's move on. Tell me about, I didn't get to see it, Cha-Cha Real Smooth.
Okay, I will tell you about Cha-Cha Real Smooth.
Please do.
This was written and directed by Cooper Rafe. It stars Cooper Rafe.
Okay.
And it's about... This is a movie very aggressively about the post-college malaise.
Okay.
The main character is 22 years old, and he is still living with his parents. He's still sharing a room with his little brother. His mom is played by Leslie Mann. His stepfather is played by Brad Garrett. He kind of resents that he's still living with his stepfather in that teenage sort of way. And he's entering that phase where he realizes that a lot of, you know, his education and his hard work has gotten him nothing, which is a common post-college experience. A lot of people don't bound out of college directly into the career of their choice.
It's tricky because unless your college career path has a direct pipeline to where you're going, like you're going to get an internship somewhere, typically what you find is that all of the skills that allowed you to thrive in an academic environment aren't necessarily what you need to be a competent adult, and there's a period of transition as you figure out how to live, thrive, and motivate yourself
so,
now.
So he lives at home. He works at this, he's working a minimum wage job at a fast food restaurant. His mom asks him to go to a bar mitzvah at one point. He sees some things at the bar. He sees a lot of people just sort of sulking at the bar mitzvah, and he takes it upon himself to essentially take control of the room. And, like, get people up and dancing and making sure the kids are okay. And actually, like, doing some good things, like making sure a kid isn't being bullied by some other kids at the bar mitzvah. He is asked by all of the moms to do that for a living. Can you be, like, the party host? And this actually, like, taps into something we see in an introduction that when he was young, when he was, like, maybe 13 or so, he fell in love with that party host, this young woman at, like, a bar mitzvah he was going to. And he asked her out. It's like, hey, I know this is crazy, but I've fallen in love with you tonight, when he's 13. It's like, that's really sweet. I'm really flattered, but I'm old. And this starts to play out, this, like, introductory sequence starts to play itself out again when he finds himself falling in love with an older woman again, this time played by Dakota Johnson. She is the mother of an autistic teenage girl who is teased a lot at these sorts of events. And the movie follows the relationship he has with the teenage daughter. He's actually kind of starting to not be a father to her, but be kind of like a big brother to her. And also trying to insinuate and not insinuate himself into the Dakota Johnson's character's life. And she's already in her 30s. She's ready to, like, the father of her child is out of the picture, so she's dating again. And she is starting to sort of come on to this guy. And it's a little bit about the interplay of their relationship, whether or not he's... I'm sorry, I'm not making it sound interesting. I think that this movie has a lot of wheel spinning to do. There's a lot of scenes of people just sort of hanging out and talking about sort of what they're going through that doesn't seem to be adding up to sort of the larger feelings of the piece. There's a lot of stuff with the Leslie Mann character and getting into fights and stopping bullies that, you know, is interesting but isn't really adding up. The central relationship is kind of what's at the heart of this movie. And I think what it really understands and what it really wanted to put down was that post-college malaise thing.
Right.
Where you're trying to figure out what being an adult is. And he finds himself repeating a lot of the habits he had when he was much younger. Mm. He fell back on stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's very real.
It sounds like the kind of indie movie we used to get a lot of in, like, the 90s. Yeah. You're getting stuff like Clerks and Swingers.
Yeah,
and,
or it's kind of trying to... Well, or the whole Judd Apatow wave. These...
I feel like that's more typically middle-aged, but yeah.
But the idea of the adult becoming an adult. Somebody who's already reached adulthood, but they're not behaving like an adult yet. It's what Knocked Up is about. That's what The 40-Year-Old Virgin is about.
But that's my point. Is those are more about midlife crises. You're talking about the quarter-life crisis, which is a bit more of a... modern, maybe not a modern phenomenon, but it's only more recently been talked about
codified and identified.
Yeah.
I feel like when it's dealing with that, this is really strong.
Mm.
I think maybe the biggest issue is, and this is probably by design, is that he's not a very interesting person. But I think the idea is he's not a very interesting person yet. Like, he hasn't developed...
But that's still a danger, though, when you're like, the point of your movie is your protagonist isn't very interesting, but that... Maybe that's also a mistake.
Right. So
that's not necessarily a good idea.
When you see him longing for Dakota Johnson, it's like, you got something else in your life going on? And he does, because he's a big brother. And there's actually a few real sweet moments where he's giving his younger brother some pretty good advice on how to approach young women.
Yeah.
He has a crush on this girl. It's like, how do I talk to her? I want to have my first kiss. What do I do? And his little brother's like about 12.
Oh, okay. Really? Yeah.
So it's like, I want to hold a hand. I don't want to kiss for the first time. What do I do? And he's actually, 40% is like sort of your attitude.
Mm-hmm.
10% is just the physical stuff. Like, you make sure. And 50% is her.
Yeah.
Like that felt like really good advice.
That is good advice. It's not about you doing something. It's about you actually connecting
with somebody. The two of you sharing something. Half of it is going to be her coming to you. So don't try to think of you taking something from her.
I haven't heard the speech, but that's not bad advice.
That's not bad advice.
And of course,
later in the movie, he goes through some heartbreaks. So he's like, no, it was bad advice. Don't listen to me. And then reneges again. And there's a really sweet moment near the end where sort of he and his brother kind of reconcile. There's a sweet moment where he and his mother reconcile. All of those emotional beats are really good. There's something not quite all the way there, though. And I think it's because the lead character doesn't have a lot to sort of fall back on in terms of who he is outside of his relationship with the people around him. He's like sort of the personality-free protagonist in little ways that are a little kind of difficult to define.
Is it because there's two different kinds of movies you can do about anything really. There's uplifting and melancholy. There's good ending, bad ending, or happy ending, sad ending. Yeah. Is this one of those like upbeat kind of movies where things are going to be more or less okay, and that's the basic message?
You understand from the start that he's going to have some sort of minor catharsis by the end.
Okay.
And move on
because,
and grow up. Because that's what the movie is about.
Because the other version of that, I think maybe the best example of that, is The Graduate. Which is also some of those sort of about a guy getting out of college, sort of falling prey to... a certain amount of ambitious lethargy. Like, he doesn't actually want to pursue anything right now. He thinks, I just got out of college, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes kind of like this salacious romantic affair that's like the path of least resistance. It requires no emotional connection from him in order to have it. And by the end of the movie, there's this big epic moment, but the movie ends with just sort of like a, this doesn't really fulfill anything, does it? Like,
just,
this doesn't actually, like,
we just did
solve
that
any
we needed,
problems.
We needed something to do in that moment.
Yeah, like, we don't actually, like, have any answers. We haven't really reached anything. It's just fucking, life, huh? Like, that kind of thing. And I feel like sometimes the happy ending for a young person sometimes feels a little insincere because they're young and they haven't necessarily solved anything yet.
If they've reached a point where they can start growing.
Yeah.
And that's Cha-Cha Real Smooth.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. So you liked it?
I liked it okay. I liked it okay.
Okay.
It's not earth-shattering. I think there's a lot of things that I've seen in other indie films. You were talking about films from the 90s. Yeah,
yeah.
They just do a lot of those beats. But I feel this is a common experience for a lot of people who are 22, who have reached a point where they're trying to sort of choose their path.
Mm.
And the idea was supposed to be that college was going to do that for you. I want to say that college, by the way, is not supposed to be necessarily vocational. A lot of people think that that's what higher learning is supposed to be about. It's the thing that puts you into the workplace.
That's not it.
That's
well, it's part of it. But
it's one of many, many things that a college education is
not even necessarily the most important part.
No, college education is about the education. It's about exposing yourself to the world. In many cases, a lot of people are leaving home for the first time.
Yeah.
It's about figuring out yourself for the first time.
Yeah.
It's not about getting a job. If it gets you a job, great.
Yeah, and some places require a college education, but a lot of places didn't really matter what you studied.
Yeah, like, and it's, so this is my way of saying it's okay to study philosophy in college. It's okay to be a philosophy major. It's okay to be an anthropology major. It's okay to write poetry.
If you're not going to be happy being an architect or a lawyer or an accountant, then don't do that. It's a waste of time. Like, it's, there are times in my life where I regret not going into a more financially lucrative position, because here I am. I can't afford to see Lightyear this week. Mm. On the other hand, I think to myself, yeah, but if I was doing anything else, I'd be really unhappy and it wouldn't be worth it.
Well, and
you know? And I found that out about myself.
A lot of people have very positive college experiences despite whatever they do for a living. And I think that's what I think college ought to be about. It's about giving you the tools to become an adult, not to just get a job.
Anyway.
That's a mercenary view of college. And I appreciate that something like Cha-Cha Real Smooth, to bring it back around, it is about finding adulthood rather than getting a job. Getting a job is part of that, but it's not the main part of that.
Well,
it's about finding maturity and learning a little bit more about yourself.
Speaking about finding maturity and learning a little bit more about yourself, there's another remake of Father of the Bride.
Another one, number six.
Yeah, well, not the sixth remake, but it's the third proper remake. No, it's the second remake. Look, there was a movie called Father of the Bride in 1950. It starred Spencer Tracy as a man whose daughter, played by a young Elizabeth Taylor, is getting married. It's taken him rather by surprise. And the movie is really sweet. If you've never seen it, it's aged quite nicely because a lot of the problems are very similar to what we have today, which is why we keep remaking it. It is about how weddings are tricky. If you're having a big wedding, it's a whole hell of a lot of trouble. It's really complicated. It's not always fun. It's full of a lot of stress. And on top of it all, while you're trying to put on a big hullabaloo, you're going through a lot of emotional stuff. Much of it positive, but all of it intense. So here's a guy who is just getting used to the idea that his daughter is a grown-up, and now is getting used to the idea that she is partnering off with somebody, and he's going to see a lot less of her, and she's making all these decisions that will have nothing to do with him anymore, and while he's very happy for her, it's very melancholic for him, and he doesn't have time to really indulge and engage with all of those feelings, because, damn it, we also have to find a venue, and we also have to cater, and all this kind of stuff. And the original is great. It led to a sequel called Father's Little Dividend about his daughter having a child. It is also very cute. And then in the 90s, they remade it with Steve Martin and Diane Keaton. And that version is also very good. And I would actually argue is even funnier than the original. It's the same basic story. They really didn't need to change it. It's just a little bit more contemporary. That had a sequel, which is also a remake of Father's Little Dividend, called Father of the Bride Part 2. And that is also very cute.
In the original in Father's Little Dividend.
Yeah.
Because I've seen Father of the Bride Part 2, the one from 95.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen the originals.
Yeah.
And in Father of the Bride Part 2,
His
daughter is now having a child.
Yeah.
So he has to get used to the idea of being a grandfather. But his wife is also having a child.
Yeah.
So he's going to be raising another kid while also being a grandfather. And all the stress that causes in his life.
Yeah, if memory serves, in the original, there's only the one baby. I don't think his wife actually is pregnant as well. I could be remembering that wrong. It's been a while since I've seen Father's Little Dividend. But regardless, I actually think that they actually made some good decisions in adapting. And I think that this new version, which stars Andy Garcia, actually also adds a nice little dramatic wrinkle. Andy Garcia plays a Cuban immigrant. He is living a successful life as an architect. He has two daughters, played by Adria Arjona and Isabella Merced. Great cast. His wife is played by Gloria Estefan.
Hey, I like Gloria Estefan.
And
I see her in movies a lot.
It's a shame. She's a really good actor, actually. She's really good in this. So the plot of all the Father of the Brides is their daughter is coming home and she's going to have a big announcement. And the announcement is, surprise, I'm getting married to a guy you didn't even know about. In Father of the Bride 2022, that night was the night that Andy Garcia and Gloria Estefan were planning to tell their kids they were getting a divorce.
Oh, all right.
So that's the wrinkle. That's the big shift besides, obviously, the major cultural change. Is the drama is actually kind of going in separate directions. All where right. It's not just about, we had our family and everything's really, really nice, but it's actually our marriage is falling apart, while our daughter's marriage is actually coming together and it's really healthy. That's pretty clever. It's simple, but it adds a lot to it. And there's a lot of really wonderful scenes with Andy Garcia and Gloria Estefan. Like, they're driving to their in-laws' yacht because it turns out they're incredibly wealthy, and it makes Andy Garcia, who's already very successful, like really insecure. But they're like, they're driving there and they're laying out ground rules because they still haven't told anyone yet. The daughters, they're about to, we have a big announcement, but I have a big announcement too. I'm getting married. What was your big announcement? We'll tell you later. Like, they want to wait until after the wedding to reveal it because they don't want to bring everybody down. So they're putting on a facade and they're driving to this party and they're just saying, like, okay, what are the ground rules? Do we hold hands? And Gloria was like, yeah, we can hold hands. Can we dance? If we must. Kissing? Hell no. Like, it's actually like, it's really sad, actually, but they're very sweet. Adria Arjona is really wonderful in this. Isabella Merced plays her younger sister, which is a new character for the film. She gets to design the wedding outfit, which makes this also feel a little bit like that Alan Alden movie, Betsy's Wedding, which is one of my favorites. If you've never seen it, it's great. It's got one of the most amazing casts ever. It's got Alan Alda. It's got Madeleine Kahn. It's got Catherine O'Hara. It's got Joe Pesci.
Molly Ringwald
and Ally Sheedy. You've got Anthony LaPaglia. You got Burt Young, Samuel Jackson in an early role. Like, it's just a great cast. So, yeah, but other than that, this is a pretty straightforward remake of the film. He's getting used to the idea of his daughter growing up. And you know what? Still works. There's nothing wrong with that. That's still real human drama in a whimsical setting. The wedding is still getting out of control, and there's a big disaster that happens towards the end. Still works. And you know what? If you've ever been married or had any other like major event like this, you know shit happens. It's real. It's actually like, it doesn't even feel false. It doesn't feel contrived. It's like, no, something always fucks up. There's always something, like it rains or like the fish is bad. Something always happens that fucks up.
In the 1991 version.
Yeah.
It snows. It takes place in Los Angeles and it snows the night before the wedding. And there's a really great scene of the wedding planner using a hairdryer on the tulips she planted.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I'm gonna save these tulips, and the tulips die. Like, that's the big tragedy in that movie.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Father of the Bride and Father of the Bride Part 2 are movies I saw multiple times, and they stress me the fuck out.
Yeah.
I can't watch those movies.
I sympathize. There's a scene in Father of the Bride Part 1 where Steve Martin is just grocery shopping, and that's where he has his panic attack.
Yeah.
He's like, why are there a different number of hot dogs and hot dog buns? He just starts ripping out hot dog buns and he ends up getting arrested. I get why he did that. Even as a kid, I got why he did that.
The entire joke of the movie is this wedding is really expensive.
Yeah.
I have to worry about money and that's stressing me out. And that's not fodder for comedy for me. That's just fodder for stress.
Yeah.
A little too relatable to find funny.
They try to take this is one of those movies where everyone is pretty affluent. I don't remember. I feel like Spencer Tracy was comfortable. I don't remember if he was rich in the original.
Yeah, They're pretty wealthy. Off,
He's like runs like a tennis shoe company, and in this one he's a successful architect. And in both versions, their family they're marrying into is wealthier. But I think this is one of those rare occasions in which making the protagonists reasonably well off actually helps the movie a little bit because it takes the sting off.
Okay.
It's not like if something
fails, they're not going to be destitute.
They're not going to lose the house, you know? It's just not going to be a great wedding or something. Or, oh, like, you have to sell a car
I'd love to see, like, the Frank Capra version of this where both families are destitute.
But they're pretending to be.
They have to construct a really expensive looking or, like, as lavish a wedding as they can pull off. Mm-hmm. So it's about like sort of rallying and getting together all of their resources, and it turns out the whole town has to pitch in. And
that's cute.
I'd like to see that.
There's a fun version of that in Betsy's Wedding where Alan Alda's. It starts off the same as daughter's getting married, and he ends up in a bit of a pissing contest with her boyfriend's wealthy family, saying, "I will pay for everything," and he's doing okay, but he's not like super rich, and like they just keep escalating how big the wedding is supposed to be, and he ends up turning to his brother-in-law, played by Joe Pesci, who is trying to get into the mob. Knows a mafia. He's like a lawyer or something, and he's working with a mafioso played by Burt Young, and he's trying to get in good with the mob. That's his vanity. That's his job. That's what he wants to do. And so Alan Alda says, "Okay, so you can get me like a cheap wedding tent because we need a giant tent and they're super expensive." And Joe Pesci's just like, "I know a guy." And he goes to the mafia. And of course, the mafia, they don't get him a waterproof tent. So when it rains, it starts sagging. Like, it just starts getting, like, falling on everybody gradually throughout the wedding. And it's really funny. And they finally, the guy's just like, "Well, what do you want for nothing?" And Alan Alda's like, "Nothing? I gave him so much money for this." So everyone's just getting screwed on it. Anyway, the new father of the bride works as a story. It is not the funniest version of it. Andy Garcia just isn't as funny as Spencer Tracy or Steve Martin, but he's very convincing. And as a result, I think this is a very sweet film that really works and is like, it's a great, they released it on Father's Day. Great choice. Absolutely something to watch with the whole family. Everyone will enjoy it and get something out of it. It's very satisfying. Not a sour note in the film, really. It's just not as funny as the other ones. So, there's that. But it works. It's a sweet film. I enjoyed watching it. I'm glad they made it. It's a nice film.
Mm.
Boom. There you go. Anyway, that is it for our main movie reviews. Let's do a quick review roundup on the critically acclaimed scale. Once again, we review films on a scale of C- to C+, where C- is below average. We don't recommend that. That's below average. A C is average. Some good. Some bad. Maybe it's just okay, but if you're a big fan of the genre, you'll like it more than other people. It's a C. And a C+ is we genuinely recommend this movie, either because it's quite good or because it's the greatest thing ever or anything in between. On that note, the 2022 remake of Father of the Bride, very high C.
All right.
Not so great you have to run out and see it, but if you're looking for something to watch with the whole family, it's a nice watch. You will all have it a good time. Cha-Cha real smooth.
Also a high C. There's a lot that it's doing right. It's not earth-shattering. It's not terribly complex, but it is relatable if you've ever been 22.
Spiderhead, I'm gonna give it a C.
Okay,
it's a comfortable C. It's got some good ideas, not great implementation. I think some of the casting it doesn't work, but it's definitely, if you're a fan of 70s type sci-fi, you'll get some entertainment out of it. But I'm not entirely sure it has enough punch to really work on the level it's trying to work on.
I think the satire could be taken a lot further. I think there's just sort of a basic story problem with Spiderhead, but I did like the characters a lot.
Yeah.
Talked plenty about how much I liked the Chris Hemsworth character. I'm going to give it a high C.
Okay.
It's not grand. If it had followed through, it would have been.
I feel like if it had been weirder and funkier and like acknowledge that it's not really about all that much, it would have been great. Or if it had been like really heady. And, yeah, like actually really pushed its big idea. Like, one or the other, but it's kind of trying to have it both ways, and neither one really, really shines.
I do think that Chris Hemsworth is excellent in this movie.
I think he's very good. I don't think he's going to get an Oscar nomination for it.
Well, no, he's not.
And then lastly, I didn't see Lightyear. Tell me about Lightyear.
Lightyear, C-. You can skip this one. This is Pixar at their least creative.
Ouch.
Isn't that their worst?
That's pretty low for Pixar. They're usually pretty good.
This isn't the kind of film I'm going to be thinking about a lot of. There's not a lot of ideas in here. There's not a lot of interesting design in here. There's not an interesting story in here.
Yeah,
Buzz Lightyear's not an interesting character. The cat is the best part. The talking robot cat that can figure out like complex math problems. That's a fun joke.
Is there any movie in which a talking robot cat wouldn't be the best?
I suppose
part?
Not. There's a the cat also, because it's a robot, it has like tools. There's a bit where it like breathes a torch, like it has to light something on fire, and it has a little laser pointer in its mouth that it ends up chasing for one scene.
Okay, that's funny.
Cute gags like that with the cat. Nothing outside of the cat has any kind of cute gags like that.
All right. Well, anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with reviews of films like, is Elvis this week? Is that next week?
Elvis is this week. Elvis and the Black Phone are coming.
Elvis and the Black Phone are the big releases this week. We'll be back with reviews of those two films. And others
and
as
maybe
well.
Maybe others besides.
Probably others as well. And of course, stick around because we've got mail this week. We're going to catch up to Cancel Too Soon and Critically Reclaimed in the very near future as well. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have a lot of exclusive shows, including our show Holy Batman, where we've been reviewing every single installment of the Adam West and Burt Ward Batman universe. We have Only the Best, where we've been reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, and in a couple of episodes we'll be talking about Father of the Bride, which was nominated for Best Picture in 1950, so we'll go into more detail about the original there and we'll rewatch it. We also got our show All Our Yesterdays. We're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek in order. We've got commentary tracks, trivia nights, a lot of stuff going on over there. Patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Thank you to everybody who supports the show financially. It means the world to us. Thank you. Our shows would not exist without you. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts. And if you can't afford to become a patron, we totally get it. Leave us a review. That helps us out. Wherever you find us, a review helps us go up in algorithms and such and get recommended. So thank you to everybody for that. You can also contact us via email if you have any questions, concerns, critiques of our critiques. We might read them on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. Box, if that's your bag. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
It is Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641-565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
We are on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I am @WhitneySeibold.
And never forget. Oh, I forgot. Everyone's a critic.
There you go.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?